The matter now before the court is Waldo 2219, and that's Jeffrey Mabee et al. Versus Nordic Aqua Farms et al. We are streaming the oral argument in this case live on the web, and counsel appear ready to argue. I've been given the, I understand that the appellants are splitting the argument. Is that correct? Okay. And for appellant.
Good morning. May it please the court. David Callan for Nordic Aqua Farms, Inc. Where the boundaries are on the face of the earth is a question of fact. And the critical fact that was alluded to in Justice Stanfill's question earlier was where the corner is where northerly Bipoor meets easterly by Penobscot Bay. The court found, as a matter of fact, where that corner was, and that corner is at the southerly corner of the Fred Poor upland. The flats that go with the Butler deed in 1950 are only those flats that are appurtenant to that lot. The colonial method line would be fixed to that corner. It would not extend to all of the flats that the grantor might have owned at that time. That rule of construction would have the exact result that that Justice Stanfill alluded to, where the original conveyance would have conveyed out all of the intertidal zone, and there wouldn't have been any to convey to the others. The last lot, the Butler conveyance, is not described as the remainder of my parcels minus everything I've conveyed. It says a portion of the property described, and it describes that expressly. And so that issue really is critical, because the outcome here is what the plaintiffs own. If you accept the hypotheticals that there was a severance in 1946, then the result of that is that it would have been retained by Harriet Hartley, because it was never conveyed to the Butlers. And in this case, and in the trial record, release deeds were obtained for all of those heirs. They turned out not to be important as a matter of fact, because the court found critical facts with regard to the 1946 deed.
If we find that the 1946 deed was unambiguous in its calls, that's it. Then we don't go past that to look at extrinsic evidence. And then we're just looking at, okay, so the intertidal land did not go in the 1946. And so what you're saying is if we accept that 1950, we have an orphan intertidal piece of property, shouldn't we presume that that wasn't the intended result in 1950?
No. The court can't presume, the court has to interpret the 1950 deed under the rules of construction. But I also disagree with two of your premises. One, when you say, if the 1946 deed is unambiguous, then doesn't that end things? And I want to make a critical distinction between what a deed describes, which I'll call the deed description, and what a deed conveys. And there is a rule of construction. The colonial presumption is sometimes referred to.
The colonial presumption is to deal with where you're vertically putting down the title. It doesn't go to whether you are conveying that title.
So I'll disagree that the colonial method is the method of determining which flats. That's a specific thing. Separating that, there's a rule under the ordinance, the colonial ordinance rule, that says a description of upland conveys the flats. The flats are presumed to be owned by the upland owner, and proof of ownership of the upland is sufficient proof of ownership of the flats unless that presumption is rebutted by proof to the contrary. And this gets at the critical distinction I was talking about between what a property describes and what it conveys. You can have an unambiguous description of waterfront upland, and by definition, waterfront upland ends at the high water mark. Waterfront upland cannot extend into the intertidal zone. If you have an unambiguous description of waterfront upland, and you have silence and no reservation of the flats, as a matter of law, the flats go with that.
But it's not silent. It says along the high water mark, doesn't it?
So,
it doesn't say to the sea.
So it makes a measurement along the high water mark. It does go to the sea. It goes to a point in the mouth of the brook. The mouth of the brook is where a brook hits the sea. So it goes to the sea.
Wasn't there a stipulation, though, that the boundary that's used, the monument that's being used, was actually at the high water mark, i.e. the pin in the brook?
No. The stipulation was that the two pins were in the same general location, but the court found, as a matter of fact, that the pin that was located was below the high water mark of the tidal brook. The court did that with reference to a survey. If you go and look at the survey the court referenced, that the whole area of that brook is tidal. The plaintiff surveyors, and what they're arguing is that there's this convoluted separation between that intertidal zone and the intertidal zone outside of the mouth of the brook. But by definition, everyone agrees that placing something in the mouth of a brook, it is underwater.
What was the impact of the 1970 quiet title action?
The 1970 quiet title impact really, as a matter of law, probably had no impact because it used the identical description to the Butler deed. So it couldn't have done anything that the Butler deed didn't already do. It just quieted title to that description. Now, the flip side is there are some facts that make really clear that the Butler deed wouldn't, as a matter of fact, included the poor intertidal zone, because the Ferris case was in 1970. Until 1975, the cottage was extending over the high tide line, as the court found, and Fred Poor still owned that property. He's not a defendant there. There's no world in which
he only owns title. That property if we find that the 1946 deed was ambiguous, correct?
No. So he owns the upland regardless. And what I'm saying is you would never quiet title to an intertidal zone that stretches in front of someone else's upland that they would be presumed to own without naming them as a defendant. That
he
just
wasn't
wouldn't
the
happen.
Poor or the family was not a defendant right. In the 1970
quiet title. And it was Fred Poor himself. It was still the same individual.
Yeah.
That individual who rented the cottage. But that gets to the second point, which is even if there is an unambiguous description that would create a severance, what I would say is no patent ambiguity in the deed. The four corners are unambiguous, and you reject the issue that I've just discussed about the flats going as a matter of law.
How does our decision in Almeida affect your argument that the flats were presumptively conveyed?
Yeah, so the decision in Almeida is actually like grounds this argument quite closely. And so paragraph 37 in Almeida lays out the application of the presumption and when it can be rebutted by within the deed itself. The facts in Almeida were that they'd never had waterfront upland, right? They didn't get past the dry sand. In that case, the presumption didn't apply to begin with because they stopped at the top of the bank. But that's the critical thing when you look at all
paragraph of 37 of Almeida says that you have the presumption when you use terms like Atlantic Ocean, Ocean Cove, Sea, or River. Here we have a call to the high water mark. So how do you get this presumption?
That call is actually to the high water mark of Penobscot Bay. And I want to talk about that because a line in the sand has a few different meanings, right? If you have waterfront upland, the presumption applies.
Well, only if you're using language like Atlantic Ocean, Ocean Cove, Sea, or River, correct?
So here we have mouth of the river and we have high water mark of the bay. And if you look at the next sentence, what it says defeats the presumption is if you have words of exclusion to or by or from,
Mr. Kalin,
you then have an estate of land.
If the presumption is overcome, is it possible that that piece, the intertidal land, is an orphan, as the term has been used, that is still out there and has never been conveyed? And therefore belongs to the heirs of the Hartleys and not to the Mabies?
I think that's what you were saying, and that's why you got release deeds from the heirs.
As a matter of fact, it was actually in the trial court record. Nordic has release deeds from all those living heirs. That was a matter of dispute at trial as to whether those deeds did anything. And then subsequent, as is clear from the city's brief, the city has actually acquired the property both by deed from the Eckroads and then condemned by eminent domain any interest that might be out there so they can use it as a park. So
what is the status of the condemnation action?
The condemnation action has stayed waiting this court's decision in this case because the because the trial court, as a matter of law, held that there was no interest to be condemned. And so rather than fight about whether the condemnation was lawful, that's all being stayed to see whether there is any interest to be condemned.
I'm going to harken back to how you started. Are you at this point conceding that maybe owns the intertidal land in front of the adjacent, what is it, Schweik? I forget the name of the people, but...
There's that
or issue. You just don't care.
Yeah, the Schweikerts did not appeal, and we did not appeal on that issue.
Okay. So you're conceding that. We're really only fighting
really
about the intertidal land.
We're talking about the intertidal zone under which
it's
the
good
pipes
if you don't
buried.
Interrupt me when I'm finishing
oh,
my question. So you are talking only about the intertidal land in front of lots 37 and 38?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
But I do want to get back to the language in paragraph 37 when it talks about how you defeat the presumption, because that really is critical to understanding this difference between a description and what is conveyed. And those things that are excluded, all of those things are estates in land, right? It talks about words of exclusion together with something, language like beach or shore or flats. That's a strip of land. And that's actually important in understanding the Lappish decision, because the same issue, Lappish was a case about bank, and bank is also a strip of land. And in the Proctor case from 1905 or 1910, the court talks about it being a strip of land that's essentially the dry sand, that it starts at the high water mark and goes up, which is the outcome in Alameda, right? That strip of land was excluded.
Let me ask you this. If the boundaries described are at either end of the description up to the bay, are at the high water mark, you agree then that, and I'm talking about the 1946 deed, that assuming that those are at the high water mark, then the call along the bay means that we are excluding the shore.
No, I disagree with that.
Well, let me back up then. I thought I understood you to say that the description in the deed that says, let me get to it, right. To an iron bolt at the mouth of the brook, that actually is not at the high water mark, and that therefore that's why there is an ambiguity. But if one assumes that is at the high water mark, is my question, then along the high water mark to a stake at the outlet of a gully, you don't agree that would then exclude
I agree that then you'd have an unambiguous description of waterfront upland. And okay. As a matter of law, absent words of reservation, which don't exist in this deed, the flats would convey together with that upland. So
well,
you
that's
can
not
describe.
Really what we said, though, was it Whitmore and Brown, is it? I mean, if it's an unambiguous call from the high water mark to the high water mark along the bay, then that is considered to exclude the intertidal land.
In the Whitmore case and in all of the cases where the court has found a severance, none of them are only the high water mark of the water body. All of them are coupled with what the court has described as an estate in land, the beach or the bank, or in some cases the margin of a cove. And then when you read the case, the factual record was that was actually understood to be a strip. So when you say to or by the shore, so I would agree that if it were to or by the high water mark of the shore, that would be a severance. And I think this is an important distinction. If it's to or by the high water mark of the ocean, then that is not, because that is just unambiguous waterfront upland. But if you're to or by a strip of land, the court has said that strip of land, using regular terms of deed exclusion, that's a reservation of that strip of land.
But in Hagen we said, and I quote, a grant to the shore and then by the shore, unqualified, excludes the shore. But when one or both termini of that call are at the low water mark, it includes the land to the low water mark. The 46D did not include termini to the low water mark, did it?
Exactly, but the first part is the critical point I'm making. The shore is a strip of land. If you call to the water the land under the water, that is a fundamentally different boundary than if you call to the
but
water.
How can a call to the high water mark include any part of the intertidal zone? I'm not getting that.
Yeah, I'm not understanding that argument.
So it's a great question. If you were to say 275 feet to Penobscot Bay, That point, 275 feet, would be at the high water mark of Penobscot Bay. The fact that you used Penobscot Bay doesn't...
Why?
So if the high water mark, I was just using the example that was asked earlier on the culvert. If the high water mark is 275 feet from the road, and you start at the road and you go to a point 275 feet at Penobscot Bay, that point will be at the high water mark. The fact that you called to Penobscot Bay is not a call to the low water mark. It's a call to the ocean that the court has said can be anywhere along that, and that's enough to trigger the presumption.
But it's not, in the 46 deed, it's not a call to the Penobscot Bay. It's a call that says along the high water mark of Penobscot Bay. That's very different.
So as a matter of fact, the court found that the point was below the high water mark, and that was not...
Well, now you're returning that back. You're making a circular argument. That's assuming it's below the high water mark. My question was assuming it was at the high water mark.
So I, and if I may just respond.
You may.
So, and I was trying to answer the hypotheticals making that assumption, but when you said the 1946 deed, I was understanding you to be talking as a matter of fact, and the court found specific facts as to that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And in rebuttal, Attorney Tucker.